Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
If you wish to listen to a lecture well, one of the things you need to try to do is to separate out what is being lectured on from the personal quirks of the lecturer. It would be unjust and unhelpful to attribute to St. Thomas the peculiarities of Thomists. I'm going to either deprive you or spare you, depending on your perspective, of the burden of discovering some of my peculiarities and quirks by telling you two of them outright. One is that I seldom resist the urge to divide a talk into question words. Another is that I like to count the divisions, subdivisions, and sub-subdivisions. I mention these quirks in particular because, although St. Thomas also has them, the particular way that they come out in his treatment of acedia is different from the particular way that I will be using them in this talk. This is to say, I'll be posing different questions than St. Thomas does. Some of these questions will be aimed at acedia, which Thomas does, and others will be aimed at Thomas's account of acedia, which Thomas obviously doesn't. My hope is that the difference between my manner of questioning and St. Thomas's will be helpful for making clear to us modern-minded people what scholastic-minded Thomas means. But, in case it isn't, please direct your complaints at me rather than at St. Thomas in the complaint period following the talk. Before jumping into the questions we'll be asking in our assessment of Aquinas' account of acedia, I'd like to consider a preliminary question, just one. The question is this: whether you will regret sticking around in order to assess Aquinas' account of acedia. The answer depends, at least in part, on whether what you're hoping to receive is what I'm intending to offer. Here are four things that you might hope to receive, only one of which I'm intending to offer. If you're here only because you were impressed by the alliteration in my title, and because you're hoping to hear some more rhetorical flourishes, you should know that all of my rhetorical prowess was poured out on the title, and that any alliteration afterward will likely be accidental. If you're here only because you wanted to know in which camp I fall regarding the correct pronunciation of the last word of the talk's title, Acadia, Acedia, Achadia, or Sloth, you should know that I'm saying Acedia not out of any deep convictions, but out of habit, and because in spite of my desires to confuse things even further, I couldn't train myself to consistently say Acadia. If you're here because you're hoping that I will be assessing Aquinas' account of acedia as a viable synthesis of the writings of Evagrius of Pontus and John Cassian, or that I'll be assessing Aquinas' account of acedia as an accurate diagnosis of the root problems of modern culture, you should know that my intention is to assess Aquinas' account in a different manner. In particular, I propose to assess Aquinas' account for its capacity to clarify for us our personal experience, for its capacity to allow us not only to pick out the experience of acedia among similar experiences, but also to point to particular things that we can respond to practically in the experience of acedia, if we happen to have picked it out in our own personal experience. All this is to say, my intention in this talk is to present Thomas's account of acedia as something practical, which should not be merely thought about, but used. So, if you're here because all you know about acedia is that it's a bad thing, and you'd like to know what a brilliant saint said it was, just in case you have acedia, and just in case there's some sort of cure for it, you hopefully won't regret sticking around. Practically speaking, our assessment of Thomas's account will have four parts. Each part will be a question posed, as it were, to St. Thomas about acedia. In the first part, we'll ask where, in our experience, we find acedia. In the second part, we'll ask why acedia is so bad. In part three, we'll consider how we should respond to acedia. And the question that I'll pose in the fourth and concluding part will be a surprise. Part one, where in our experience is acedia? What I have in mind in this part is to play something like Where's Waldo with St. Thomas. I'll pose to St. Thomas a narrative containing a series of experiences that most of us would agree probably contain acedia, but out of which few of us would be able to pick out acedia with confidence. After presenting the narrative, we'll invite St. Thomas to tell us what he sees, namely where acedia is, and then anything else he notices. Two preliminary comments, just because this is the last opportunity I have to make comments in my own voice before I get distracted by pretending to be St. Thomas. First, I'm not proposing this Where's Waldo game merely as a fun starter. I think it's very common for us to be confused about where acedia shows up in our experience. There are three reasons why we might not notice an instance of acedia in our personal experience. First, it's not necessarily in our experience, at least in its fully fledged form. It's always there as a possibility, namely as something into which we might fall, but it's not a foregone conclusion that we have fallen. So if, after the talk, your friend insists that she doesn't experience acedia, you won't be doing her any favors if you say, denial is the first stage of acceptance. The second reason why we might struggle to pick acedia out in our experience is because, according to St. Thomas, acedia is a particular kind of sorrow. But sorrows can look a lot alike and can blend together in our experience. It's not always easy for us to tell whether the sorrow that we're feeling right now is primarily because the steak that we ate this morning was overcooked, or because we just realized that today is and was, at breakfast time, a Friday in Lent. A third reason it can be hard to determine whether acedia is in our experience is because the individual effects of acedia, which we'll identify shortly, can be caused either by acedia or by something entirely different. St. Thomas believes that slowness of movement, for example, can be caused either by acedia, by fear, or by a temperamental imbalance of phlegm in one's bodily humors. So to conclude that your friend has acedia merely from the fact that she seems particularly sluggish is just as rash as concluding that she hates meat from the fact that she ate sardines for breakfast while you were eating steak. My second preliminary comment is a defense of the way that I'm proposing that we examine acedia in this part, which is to say, playfully. At first glance, it seems like the most fitting approach to a grave topic is to give it in a grave manner. What's actually most fitting, though, is to approach a grave topic in a manner that allows us to register just how grave it really is. We can't register things well, that's to say, we can't internalize them or represent them clearly in our imaginations unless we can give them sustained attention. And our attention is best sustained when there are at least some opportunities when we can relax, when there are some things that are already clear and familiar, and thus fair game for being played with. It's as though we need something light on which we can hang our heavy observations. I'm not saying that just any kind of levity will help sustain our attention. The playfulness or the silliness has to be strategic. It has to be somehow close to the grave topic without being about it, without either mocking it or entering into competition with it. So you can let go of the fear that I'll be delivering the rest of this talk in my best pirate accent. But you should know that, at least in this part of the talk, I will be engaging in a bit of silly dialogue with St. Thomas. So now that those of you who have already been laughing at me feel justified, let's move on to the Where's Waldo or Where's Acedia game. And for maximal effectiveness, of course, try locating acedia yourself before St. Thomas jumps in. Meet Polycarp, Junior. Polycarp is unusual, not only in that he's named Polycarp, and that he's heir to a fish hatchery that's been in the family for generations. But also, and that he's never even imagined doing anything more noble or enjoyable than working in a fish hatchery. For as long as he can remember, Polycarp has known that he was named both after his father, Polycarp Sr., and after an ideal, namely, that there would be many carp hatched, both for feeding hungry people, especially on Lenten Fridays, and for bringing delight to those who, while waiting to be seated at restaurants, actually bother to look into the in-ground decorative pools. One day, however, while working beside his father, Polycarp Jr. was peculiarly repulsed by the smell of fish guts. So repulsed that he began to wonder for the first time whether he would have the stomach to endure the odor day after day for a lifetime. Polycarp Sr., noticing his son's grimace, said, "Just remind yourself of the good that you're doing and try to enjoy that." Rather than following this advice, Polycarp found himself growing spiteful at his father's lack of repulsion to the fish gut odor. Over the next few days, Polycarp began to take progressively longer and longer to walk to the hatchery. At the hatchery itself, the tasks that he previously did without effort became more and more difficult. His mother, Smyrna, noticing his behavior, called him lazy. When this didn't snap him out of his slowness, she bought him a bag of Swedish fish, his favorite candy, of course, hoping that he was just in need of a little treat. Polycarp seized the bag, eager to experience again the familiar gummy delight, but found that his weariness and restlessness only grew with each Swedish fish he ate. The next morning, Polycarp, wearied by his own weariness, decided to adopt a new course. Rather than giving in to his inclination to avoid the hatchery altogether, he resolved to ignore the inclination and to act as though it wasn't there. When this initially proved impossible, Polycarp redoubled his efforts, this time taking on double the tasks and doing them at double speed. Since the speed was at least somewhat satisfying, Polycarp added to his routine more and more tasks, even small tasks like refilling the break room salt shakers, hourly. Eventually, though, the thrill of moving fast and being productive wore off, and the fish smell was still there. In a rare, still moment, Polycarp decided that he would, henceforth, only answer to the name Paul. St. Thomas speaks. He begins his commentary with a rather devastating observation. Acedia is nowhere in this narrative. Acedia is sorrow over our participation in the divine good. The divine good was not explicitly mentioned in the narrative, nor did the narrative imply that the divine good came into the field of Paul's awareness. So, there was no acedia. I interject. But Thomas, I wrote this narrative and I put acedia in it. At least acedia as I understand it as a philosopher. Isn't there any way to talk about acedia from a purely philosophical perspective in a way that Aristotle might have done? Isn't there any way to present acedia not as a sorrow regarding my relationship with God, but as sorrow regarding whatever in my life takes the place of God? Namely, whatever I subjectively regard as my greatest good? Perhaps not everyone is consciously aware of what they regard as their greatest good, but surely everyone has a greatest good. Everyone has something that they're willing to work for and that they're willing to enjoy when all of the work has been done. Can't you find that in the narrative? And if you won't call sorrow regarding a subjectively greatest good acedia, won't you please at least say that it's like acedia or analogous to it? St. Thomas. As you know, my own presentation of acedia isn't philosophical or phenomenological, and that seems to me to be what you're trying to elicit from me. I am interested in acedia exclusively as something that hinders or prevents the growth of the life of God in us. This is why I write about acedia only in the Secunda Secundae of my Summa, as a sorrow that opposes the theological virtue of charity, and not in the Prima Secundae, as a sorrow that opposes the enjoyment of just any subjectively greatest good. However, since you seem so convinced that talking about fish hatcheries will be helpful for understanding acedia, I will indulge your speculative project. But before I do, let me reiterate a significant difference between the fish hatchery and the divine good, that is to say, friendship with God, as one's subjectively greatest good. It's possible for Paul to leave the fish hatchery. And even if he didn't and remained devoted to it, the fish hatchery has no ability to devote itself to Paul. In the case of friendship with God, though, God never ceases to love us and be present with us, even if we were to cease to be devoted to him. Unlike fish hatcheries, God's love is inescapable. And the quality of the sorrows that attend to these two greatest goods corresponds to this difference. I understand. So now, will you speculate for us where in the fish hatchery narrative is the analogical equivalent of acedia, where we find Polycarp sorrowing over his participation in his subjectively greatest good? St. Thomas. Yes. Acedia is nowhere in this narrative, but also everywhere. Allow me to explain. What I mean by nowhere is this. Since acedia isn't an externally observable act, we can't right out identify it with what we see Polycarp do. It's not the act of walking slowly to work, the act of filling salt shakers every hour on the hour, or eating handfuls of Swedish fish. In another sense, though, we can say that acedia is indeed here in these external acts, since it's acedia that gives rise to these acts. Thus, acedia is present in each one of them as a cause. The same is true of many of Paul's internal responses. Acedia can't be strictly identified with restlessness or despair or spite, but it's present in each of these as an underlying cause. Thomas, can you indulge us a little longer and tell us how acedia gives rise to its effects? Of course. Gregory and Isidore have different lists of what they call the six daughters of acedia. I'll spare you the details of how I synthesized their lists and will focus on four of the effects that appeared analogically in the fish hatchery story. Note that acedia is an abiding sorrow. Since prolonged sorrow is unpleasant, and since we're inclined to avoid what's unpleasant, acedia inclines us both to avoid whatever we believe is causing the sorrow and to avail ourselves of pleasant activities capable of distracting us from the sorrow that we haven't been able to avoid. To the first, we try to avoid what causes us sorrow in two ways. We can, on the one hand, try to flee the sorrow. Despair flees sorrow by saying effectively, I will stop loving the thing whose absence is causing me sorrow. Polycarp signifies his despair, his disidentification with the fish hatchery, when he changes his name to Paul. Sluggishness doesn't exactly flee sorrow, but rather fails to approach it. Polycarp's mother incorrectly identifies her son's sluggishness in his walking as laziness, namely as slowness due to the fear of the labor standing in the way of what he desired but didn't yet have. In contrast, sluggishness is slowness due to the absence of desire for what one already has. We can, on the other hand, try to fight the sorrow, or fight whatever redirects us to our sorrow. Polycarp, for example, responded to his father's patient laboring with spite, because this reminded him of what caused his sorrow. To the second, whether we succeed in our attempts of avoiding what causes sorrow or not, we tend additionally to seek to escape sorrow by availing ourselves of the pleasure of activity. We flee from sorrow, as it were, by fleeing to busyness. Thus, Polycarp did double tasks and double speed and filled the salt shakers on the hour. And I'll add, if Polycarp had been a girl, he probably would have also filled all of his silent moments with chatter. We might ask ourselves whether busyness succeeds in delivering ourselves from sorrow. To this, I would say, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. Keeping busy succeeds at distracting us from sorrow by removing one of sorrow's two necessary conditions. We're sorrowful first when something seemingly good for us is absent, or something seemingly bad for us is present, and then second, when we are aware of this absence or presence. If we make ourselves busy enough with salt shakers, we can remove the second condition. That's to say, we can prevent ourselves from resting our attention on the absence of what we love. But the relief that we get from this distraction from sorrow is very short-lived. It's not the kind of relief in which we can rest. The emotional inertia of our distractions, so to speak, is far less than the emotional inertia of sorrow. Sorrow is, by its nature, a resting with something painful. Distractions are, by their nature, a running away from or toward something else. We can't rest in our distractions precisely because they're not the things that we pursue for their own sakes, but only as something useful. And insidiously, the more we try to enjoy our distractions, the more restless we become. Thomas, I'm glad we began by identifying the effects of acedia. It seems like if many of these effects are present in our experience, it might be a sign that the cause of the effects is present too. You don't say this, St. Thomas, but I wanted to throw it out as something possibly helpful. But I'm curious now about acedia itself. You called it a sorrow regarding the divine good. And just a moment ago, you mentioned that one of the conditions of sorrow is the absence of a good. How can we experience sorrow over the love of God, which is always present? Or rather, how can Paul experience sorrow over the fish hatchery even when he's in it? St. Thomas. There are two distinctions that should suffice to answer your question. First, recall that sorrow can arise in me either because I am aware of the presence of what I hate or the absence of what I love. Second, observe that I am inclined both to love sensory goods like Swedish fish and to hate sensory evils like fish guts, and also to love noble goods like feeding hungry people and to hate ignoble evils like purposelessness. These two distinctions were displayed in different ways throughout the narrative. It's possible that, in addition to what the narrative mentioned, Paul also was sorrowful at other moments. After he ate the Swedish fish, because he was aware that the sensory good of the Swedish fish was no longer present. As he smelled the fish guts, because he was aware of a sensory evil. Or as he walked slowly to the hatchery, because he was aware that the noble good of alacrity was not present in him. How is it possible, though, to experience sorrow over the presence of something good? The answer seems to be as follows. We don't perceive and respond to the world as clearly divided into merely sensory goods and evils on the one hand, and then intelligible goods and evils on the other. Most often, we perceive things as mixed bags. Eating the entire bag of Swedish fish in one sitting without sharing is both a sensory good and an intelligible evil. And working at the fish hatchery, which smells of fish guts, is both a noble good and a sensory evil. Acedia, namely sorrow over the presence of a noble good, comes about in this way. We begin by focusing on the sensory aspects of a noble good, not merely noticing these aspects, but focusing on them. If we repeatedly focus on the sensory evils, the unpleasant aspects of the noble good, we will eventually perceive the noble good not merely as having unpleasant sensory features, but as wholly identified with these unpleasant sensory features. We don't just associate the hatchery with fish gut smell. We identify the good with the evil. We will, in this way, perceive the noble good as evil. And consequently, whenever we draw near to this noble good, or it draws near to us, we will respond as though an evil were upon us. It's for this reason that Paul found himself sorrowful even at the presence of the thought of the hatchery, namely because he had come to identify it so closely with the fish gut odor. So, that my final words in this awkward dialogue are not about fish odor, permit me to retell the sequence of internal acts about a far nobler good, namely, our participation in a loving relationship with God. We should not identify acedia with just any kind of sorrow we experience in the context of our friendship with God. Acedia isn't the sorrow of the saints. It's not the sorrow that we experience when we consider that we don't yet see God face to face. This is sorrow over the absence of a real good, our full participation in the life of God. Acedia is also not the sorrow of repentance, the sorrow we experience when we consider our resistance to receiving God's love. This is sorrow over the presence of a real evil, namely sin. Acedia is also not the lack of joy that we might experience if we were Carmelites in the dark nights of the senses or the soul. In these nights, we experience an absence of joy in sensory and even noble goods because of an absence of desire for any good other than for God himself. Acedia is, rather, the sorrow that we experience when we come to identify the unpleasant aspects of loving God with God himself. We begin, perhaps, just by noticing the arduousness of fasting or the dryness that we experience in prayer. If we allow this noticing to progress to focusing, we will come not merely to associate loving God with these unpleasant aspects, but to identify loving God with them. The narrowing of our vision, as it were, results in a qualitative distortion of the greatest significance. Part 2, a question that Thomas answered but didn't ask. Why is acedia so bad? From this point on, I'm going to shift from playfully representing what Thomas said to making some observations about what St. Thomas said. In this part, I'll direct my observations to what Thomas says regarding the badness of acedia. Even though Thomas never asks, why is acedia so bad? We can use his account of acedia to compose an answer that's far fuller than what most of our own initial answers to this question would be. Thomas, on my reading, would answer that acedia is bad in 3 ways. First, in its effects. Second, in the tendency of its disorder to progress. And third, in the magnitude of what it distorts. The first point requires little explanation. Acedia is bad because it causes in us things that are bad. Restlessness, sluggishness, and despair aren't fun. But unfun though these things may be, they are hardly the worst of the bad. A second and worse bad aspect of acedia is that its badness tends to compound itself over time. Acedia begins with a single disordered perception, which itself begins with a single movement of the sense appetite, that is to say, of our inherent or inborn inclination to pursue sensory goods and avoid sensory evils. Paul's initial sensory sorrow itself, merely as a response to smelling the fish guts, wasn't disordered. The disorder began when his sense appetite, rather than waiting upon his rational reflection to direct his attention, inclined him to focus on the fish gut smell when thinking of the fish hatchery. St. Thomas calls this overly independent tendency of the sense appetite a venial sin, and he attributes it to, quote, the opposition between the spirit and the flesh, close quote. I understand this to mean Because the sense appetite and the intellectual appetite, or the will, are inclined to different things, it's possible for the inclinations of the sense appetite to oppose the inclinations of the will, namely what we wish to do. Here's where the compounding of badness begins. Each time Paul consciously allows himself to focus on the fish gut smell when he thinks of the fish hatchery, as to say, each time he realizes that he is reducing some noble good to one of its bad aspects and consents to do it anyway, the tendency of his sense appetite to dominate his intellectual appetite grows. St. Thomas calls this confirmation of the sensory appetite's disorder by the will a mortal sin, where the flesh not merely opposes, but prevails over the spirit. But the compounding continues. With each act of Paul's consciously allowing his sense appetite to dominate his higher self, his disposition to do the same grows stronger. St. Thomas calls this stable disposition a vice. It's not just an act, but an ingrained tendency. The third, final, and arguably worst aspect of acedia's badness concerns the magnitude of the good that acedia inclines us to perceive as evil. I'm speaking here not of the magnitude of God as God. God is indeed very big. But he is also, for each of us who regard him as our ultimate end, the measure we unconsciously use when we judge the goodness and the badness of any creative thing, including ourselves. It's as though we say to God, or to whatever we regard as our subjectively greatest good, I am the kind of being that was made for you. Or perhaps, you are the only one in whom I find ultimate rest and ultimate fulfillment. Consider now the effect on our identity of coming to regard God or our friendship with him as evil while still regarding him as ultimate. It's as though we say to ourselves, I am the kind of being that was made to rest with this evil. Aren't you glad the talk is not ending here? Part three. How can we respond to all of this badness? Well, we're obviously most interested in Thomas's answer to this question, that is to say, in the remedies that Thomas recommends to those of us who find ourselves afflicted with acedia's disorder. I'd like to look first at three answers that were given before Thomas was born and that are still being put forward today. Putting these perennial answers and Thomas's side by side is helpful, both for our noticing and appreciating certain aspects of what Thomas says. I want to put Thomas's answer alongside the perennial answers for the same reason that I try not to stand next to any Dominicans who obviously take better care of their habits than I do. You only notice that white isn't quite white when you see it next to what's whiter. The three off-white answers we'll consider to the question, how should we respond to sorrow, are the Stoic answer, the Epicurean answer, and what I'm calling the whack-a-mole answer. The Stoic reply to the question, how should we respond to sorrow, runs something like this. You are not the kind of being that is supposed to experience sorrow. Since sorrow arises only in the presence of desire, the best remedy for sorrow is to eliminate, or at least ignore, all desire. This is in your control, and thus your freedom from sorrow is in your control. The Epicurean reply is surprisingly similar. It runs thus. You are not the kind of being that is supposed to experience sorrow. Since sorrow arises only when we desire more than what we have, the best remedy for sorrow is to decrease desire to match what we have. We should, as it were, decrease the denominator to match the numerator. This is in your control, and thus your freedom from sorrow is also in your control. The whack-a-mole reply differs from the previous two in not directing our efforts toward removing one of the causes of sorrow. The whack-a-moler reasons thus. You are not the kind of being that is supposed to experience sorrow. It's not in your control to avoid sorrow by eliminating its cause, but it is in your control to manage the symptoms, to prevent yourself from feeling the sorrow. To succeed at this, you must indulge in pleasures, but not become addicted to them. You must keep busy, but not become run down or purposeless. Managing the symptoms of sorrow thus requires constant effort, constant work. This work, the exercise of the will, is what gives meaning to life. I imagine that if St. Thomas were aware that his answer to the question, how should we respond to sorrow, was being juxtaposed with the Stoic, Epicurean, and whack-a-mole answers, he would want to briefly object to these answers before giving his own full response. At a minimum, I think he would want to declare three things. First, that he would not recommend any of the practices recommended by these perennial three. Second, that the only statements with which he would agree are the whack-a-mole observations that it's not in our control to eliminate the cause of sorrow, and that managing the symptoms of sorrow requires constant work. Third, the most insidious of the statements made by the perennial three are those concerning our identity, namely, those that deny that we are made both for intimate communion and for joy. As for St. Thomas's fuller answer, if we were to put to him the same question we put to the others, how should we respond to sorrow? Thomas would likely say, it depends on the kind of sorrow. We'll pass over now for what Thomas might say about smaller sorrows, but I think it's worth noting that Thomas, unlike the perennial three, thinks that the kind of sorrow matters. Thomas identifies three remedies of acedia, three things within our power to do that are specifically aimed at acedia, even if they're also good in general. The first is to keep holy the Sabbath, to rest with God. The second is to contemplate God, to rest our attention on He who alone is good. And the third is to be grateful. Thomas is silent about how any of these remedies work to free us from the disorder of acedia. My suspicion is that they work together as follows. Keeping holy the Sabbath requires that we stop yielding to busyness. Although busyness doesn't cause acedia, it can keep it in place, so to speak, by preventing us from realizing the depth of our sorrow. Resting our bodies and our minds from busyness, from any activity other than the activity of enjoying God, restores our ability to notice, without the influence of haste, what things are. In short, keeping holy the Sabbath prepares us to practice the second remedy, which is contemplation. Contemplation is the simple act of resting in God. The rest of contemplation is twofold. The first is the rest of the mind. On my plane ride here, I was seated next to a man who, for most of the flight, was watching an action movie on his cell phone. I could feel the movement of his attention, even though I was trying not to look at his screen so that I could finish composing this talk. After an hour or so, I felt something different and nosily let myself look at his screen. He was looking at a picture of himself holding his infant daughter. He was resting his attention on her. Something analogous happens in contemplation when we allow our attention to rest on God alone, not on our responses to Him, nor even how we appear in His eyes. We think, moreover, not about God, but simply of Him. The second kind of rest is the rest of the appetite, or the rest of desire. When we contemplate what we love, we not only love, but possess. That's to say, we experience the rest of joy, of simply enjoying what we have and needing no longer to desire it. This is the ultimate salve for acedia, because it is the rest of which acedia is the mockery. Acedia would have us rest in an undesirable absence. Contemplation thus both supplies for and straightens out the central distortion of acedia, namely the inclination to rest our attention on the evil or unpleasant aspects of our relationship with God. Gratitude, the third remedy, extends to things other than God, the habit of looking for and resting our attention on what is good. In order to really be grateful and not just perform external acts of gratitude, we need to rest our attention on the goodness of that for which we're grateful. I said at the beginning of this talk that we would be assessing Aquinas' account of acedia for its capacity to help us understand and respond well to our experience. My own personal assessment of Thomas's account is overwhelmingly favorable, but I do have one objection. I mentioned a few moments ago that St. Thomas has a different answer to how we ought to respond to smaller sorrows than how we ought to respond to acedia. Most of Thomas's remedies for smaller sorrows seem to me to be merely ways of managing the symptoms. He recommends that we engage in pleasant activities, including contemplation, by the way, but he also recommends taking a bath. In my experience, doing these things does indeed help to manage smaller sorrows like fish gut odor. But what, ultimately, are we supposed to do with these smaller sorrows, especially the ones that hang around and are likely to hang around for a lifetime? Thomas doesn't say. But there is someone who, without saying anything, shows us what to do. Who can show us how to respond to sorrow well? The fourth and final part. The Blessed Mother, under her title Our Lady of Sorrows, shows us how to respond to sorrow well. How so? Scripture tells us that Mary's heart was pierced by a sword. She experienced profound sorrow because she kept her heart unguarded. Scripture also tells us that Mary kept all these things, these sorrows, in her heart. She was able to keep them in her heart and yet stand at the foot of the cross, precisely because her way of keeping them was to present them in her heart to God. She did not do it on her own. The sword that pierces Mary's heart is not a barrier to her communion with God, but a boon. Mary shows us that all of our sorrows can be means to a deeper sharing of our hearts with God. The sorrow of acedia is no exception. If we find ourselves sorrowing over our relationship with God, the best response is neither to flee from the sorrow nor to fight it, but to flee to God with the sorrow, both big and small, held in our hearts. I'll close by noting that, in Mary, we seem to find not only the completion of St. Thomas's account of acedia, but also the completion of what I promised to provide in this talk, namely an assessment of Thomas's account and an answer to the question, can we choose joy? Mary, in a way, is the standard against which every account should be assessed. No account should be accepted which contradicts her, and any account should be taken seriously which confirms her. Mary's life confirms two convictions that seem to me to underline St. Thomas's account of acedia. First, we are the beings who are capable of the greatest sorrow, because we're capable of the greatest desire, the desire for God. And last, to the extent that we open our hearts to allow God to share in our sorrow, God will open his heart to allow us to share in his joy.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.